Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levanier, and coming up in this hour, science fiction. Later on, a tale from Theodore Sturgeon on Beyond Tomorrow. But right now, it's X-1 with the story The Lights on Precipice Peak. This March 13th, 1957 broadcast, first heard on NBC.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire.
Far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
The Lights on Precipice Peak by Stephen Tall.
We were sitting on the porch of the lodge, the three of us, Chuck Evers, Royston, and myself. Chuck was smoking one of those 5 for a quarter stinkers he affects, but he let it go out as we sat in the darkness, stared across the narrow valley below us, then up again to the mountains of Bighorn Glacier, 6 miles away and 7,000 feet up in the thin, cold air.
There it is. You see?
Where?
Well, follow my hand. I landed up with a tall pine tree on the first ridge. You see?
Very small, dull red.
It's been up there for about 5 minutes. I didn't see anything before. You see? Moving along. Well, it seems to be the lip of Bighorn Glacier.
Now, give me the binoculars. Yeah. Yeah, it's a glow, all right. Small but definite glow. You want to see it, Royston?
Thank you. Well, that's that.
You see it, but still you can't. The glasses didn't pick up any outline. It's still just a glow.
Spooks, that's what. Spooks.
Spooks? Yes, apparitions.
Haunts, hobgoblins, ghosts, banshees.
Well, at least these mysterious lights of Precipice Peak make no sound.
Are you sure? How do you know that every coyote that you hear is really a coyote?
Well, at any rate, if they make sounds, they're sounds of the country. A miserable country.
Sir, you're speaking of the land I love. If you don't like it, why stay around?
It is supposed to make me a man of vigor, with red corpuscles and a need for cold shower baths. Actually, there is nothing wrong with me. I was simply born to sit and watch while great louts like you run and wrestle and climb and sweat. Ah, there, the light shows again.
You can see it with a naked eye. Higher than it was before. It's moving along.
It's going along Fifth Avenue Trail. Spooks don't need a route of ascent, even on precipice. All of a sudden, the lights of Precipice Peak are getting solid. Now, I've got a feeling they'll leave a sign.
Sign? Ah, yes. Traces.
Right. Traces, tracks, boards. The only mystery about those lights is we don't know who makes them. They're getting to be a tourist attraction. Maybe that's a lead.
Over the swamps of Louisiana, where I wish I now were, I have seen balls of fire that were drifting. It is swamp gas, methane, slowly oxidizing, glowing. Could this up there on the mountain be something like?
Almost impossible. Anyhow, balls of gases wouldn't follow a trail. Those blasted lights do.
Take it easy, Chuck boy. Tomorrow you can look for yourself, remember? At daybreak, we go up to solve the mystery of the lights.
Ghastly. To go out at dawn is as bad as eating raw flesh. But tap on my cabin door as you go by. I will wave to you from the window.
were down the slope from the lodge and across the valley before the sun rose. Chuck and I swung along the trail. Felt good having your nailed mountain boots hitting the ground in regular rhythm. Ahead of me, Chuck set the pace, an easy, loose-jointed shamble that ate up the mountain miles. We were a good team for climbing. I took a deep breath when we crossed the ridge. But at the switchback, Chuck broke his stride and leaned his long frame against a boulder.
Well, tonight we'll be up where the lights are. Punch me if you see one first.
Lights not. There'll be none while we're on the peak. $5 says so.
Well, I'm not a rich man, but I love a sporting chance. Here's my $5. It's a bet. Where'll we put him?
Well, here. I'll empty this out. I got a tobacco tin. Stick it in here.
Okay.
Here's my $5. All right, we'll put it under the stone here. Nobody will find it under there. It's off the trail. All right, now. If there are lights, it's yours. No lights, it's mine. Right?
Right.
Going into the world above the trees is one of the good things of a peak climb. Quarry marmots whistled from their rocks. Conies scurried. Gray-barred ptarmigan crouched almost invisibly among the gaudy alpine fields of mountain sunflowers and tiny forget-me-nots. At dusk, we laid out our bedrolls in a level bit of tundra in the lee of a massive outcrop near Bighorn Glacier. We cooked a kettle of stew and heated the water for tea. Thin Chuck walked away a few paces from the fire to empty the kettle.
Ow! What's the matter? A stone turned under me. My ankle. Give me a hand.
I got you.
Oh, set me down again. Okay.
Now let's take off that boot and the sock.
Oh. Well, I have a feeling, my friend, that I will not climb that peak in the morning.
Get the sock off and let's see how bad it is. Well, we'll pack ice on it and save it in an hour. Maybe it's a simple twist.
Well, you know it isn't.
Sure, I know. I thought you wanted to be cheerful, that's all. It's like when I broke 3 ribs climbing to look into a bird's nest the day before we were tackling the east face of Long Peak. Then you were chin up.
Well, I was different. I wasn't hurting.
When the stars were out and the quarter moon rose from the plains, I got up from my bedroll seat by the fire. Chuck's ankle was taped, and he was easing it before him as best he could.
Well, that's not so bad for a foot. It only hurts when I try to walk on it.
Well, I want to have a look before we turn in. My $5 spot says there won't be any lights. But the technical crew may be monkeying around somewhere.
Well, take it easy.
I'll just skirt along the edge of the glacier. Back in half an hour. You take it easy. I know Bighorn Glacier. Its crevices are so consistent, they're shown on maps. I carried an ice axe, but I didn't figure to use it. And I'd worked my way for a number of minutes along the edge of the moonlit ice sheet. I suddenly got the idea that I should cross it. The glacier had a good snow covering. The going was easy, and the view was something few men see. I automatically avoided the big ice cracks. I knew where they were. And then I slipped through a snow roof and fell. I wasn't hurt. The moonlight from the crack above showed my ice axe beside me. It was a lucky fall, except for the fact that I couldn't get out again. Time after time, I tried to dig hand and foot holes into the splintering ice wall. I was freezing my fingers, making no headway. Cold was beginning to bite into me. So I settled myself on my heels quietly and tried to decide what to do.
John! John! John!
John! That was Chuck beginning to call. I knew if I answered, he'd probably try the ice himself, so I kept quiet. And after a while, he stopped calling. Then, suddenly a dark silhouette showed in the narrow crack of sky above.
Are you injured?
Well, I'm okay. Just drop me a rope and I can walk up the wall. Mind the snow ledge. I didn't, and look at me.
A joke? Here's the rope.
Hey. Hey, what kind of a rope is this? I never saw anything like it. It's warm.
Have you got it now?
Yep. Yep, here I come. Hang on. Hang on. Okay. Over the ledge. Well.
Hey. Did you hold that rope in one hand while I was climbing up?
Yes.
Well, thanks. Lucky for me, somebody has sense enough to walk around ice cracks. Shake.
Shake? Oh, shake hands. You must not mind the glove. It is for your protection. The hand is not yet cooled.
Cooled? What in the world?
Your friend with the swollen foot is concerned for you. Come, I have made an easy way.
I've climbed mountains up and down the Rockies, but I confess, following this fellow, I felt like a tenderfoot. The man's odd voice and stilted phrases tantalized me, and I knew they were not entirely strange. There was the question of his hot hand. I dropped back a couple of paces. The man was setting his booted feet into a line of holes that had not been on the glacier earlier. I could swear to that. And as we approached the edge of the glacier, I could see him clearly, for he was surrounded by a dim red glow which grew brighter with each step. In a few moments, it was as if he were outlined in flame, and I could feel a warmth radiating from him. I wondered why the snow didn't melt under his tread.
It's the boot! They insulate!
Oh, I see. Thank you. Hey, you not only light up, but you pick brains. Both good tricks.
A joke?
I guess so.
Only here on Earth are there jokes. We can never be sure about them.
We, huh? I thought a gag like this would take cooperation. How many of you boys are in on it?
We are four.
We had left the ice. We were threading along the little ledge that gave onto the boulder field. I noticed that the ruddy glow had faded completely, that the man up ahead was now simply a dark silhouette. We reached the tundra and spotted Chuck's tiny fire. He sat next to it, the tape-footed ankle eased on a pack sack before him.
Well, hello. You took your time.
I fell in a crevasse. And I owe you $5.
Huh? Oh! You should put the more important statement first. But we can take that up later. I see we have company.
Oh, yeah, this... This is Chuck Evers. I'm afraid I didn't catch your name.
I am called Zell.
Zell?
Yes.
Well, it's different anyway.
That is because I am different.
He can read your head like a crystal ball. And he lights up like a neon sign.
Easy, boy. You slipped on the ice before. Sit down. Let's quit being funny.
Let us all sit and I will tell you why I am Zell. I will do it because I know when you repeat my words that you will not be believed.
Now, listen.
You listen. You came up to climb the peak, but also you came to see what caused the light. If you had not had misfortune, you would have climbed the peak, but there would have been no light. We would not have come.
Hey, there's a light back up there where we were. You see? That red light on the glacier?
Well, yeah. Yeah, moving across.
That is Zor. We grew in the same membrane. He is erasing our trail across the ice.
Yeah, very smart. We can tell tales down there, but there won't be any proof, huh?
That is correct. Chuck Evers, you are wondering about the statement that we grew in the same membrane?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking...
I should have said that we are twins.
Holy... You're right, John. It is telepathy. You weren't out of your head.
The truth is simple. We have told it before, but no one ever believed. And it has not seemed wise to support our facts. We, Zor and I, with our companions Zim and Zet, are explorers. But we do not explore mountains. Here we rest and allow ourselves to behave normally. We explore in towns and cities where people gather. It is strenuous. We cannot tolerate it for long. Then we must go into seclusion and renew ourselves.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
10 days in Denver, and I feel like I've been staked with a short rope. I gotta get away.
Your problems are simply a matter of preference. Ours are physiological. We cannot long maintain metabolic balance in the company of people. Thus, Jim and Zet are now back in the world you inhabit. When they must rest, then our turn comes. I will show you. This is a rock. You may call it granite. To me, it is food. So.
Eat it in good health.
Thank you. Among people, this would be conspicuous. You are not adapted to get oxygen from rock. We are.
Well, I'll admit that's a tougher cereal than I'd want to try. But the point of the joke still escapes me.
There is the matter of my body glow. I can control my body temperature, raising it and lowering it as I choose. The greatest difficulty when I'm among you people is to keep myself down to human body heat. Normally, it is much higher than yours. And when, due to exercise and metabolic speed-up, excess energy is accumulated, it is satisfying to us to radiate it. Much as you get released by deep sighs, by long breaths, by stretching your limbs. Unfortunately, when we radiate rapidly in air, we glow. It has made us conspicuous. Yet, your unawareness of us is a marvel. For creatures so well supplied with adaptation for sensation, you are indeed blind.
You sound like an old professor I had once. I didn't understand him either.
Zor is waiting by the glacier. We have plans for this time. When you return to the settlement below, it would perhaps be wisest not to explain the lights.
We both sat silently beside the dying fire. When we looked up toward the upper reaches of the glacier, two gleaming spots, dull cherry red, moved steadily across the ice. They were visible for brief minutes and slowly faded. To descend Precipice Peak, even if only from Bighorn Glacier, is no fit task for a cripple. Still, we knew it had to be done. So in the early morning, we set about it. Where the going allowed it, I simply backpacked Chuck. We made use of every ledge. If Chuck could rappel himself down spots he could not climb or be carried. We were both mountain men and tough. But by mid-afternoon, we knew we'd had enough. We were lucky, though. We ran into Heine Cobb, the ranger, heading down trail with two pack horses. We stopped only once. The big switchback. I got down from my horse, pried up a stone, took the tobacco can from under it, and gave it to Chuck without a word. Back at our camp on the lakeshore, Chuck and I weren't disturbed by questions. When men fail on the peaks, they tell their own stories in their own time. Chuck's ankle showed quick improvement, and in a couple of days he was hobbling about. Only young Royston came to visit us.
You have not been back to the lodge. Perhaps you are afraid to show your faces.
People talk your arm off up there. Not many of them have the gall to come snooping around here.
You cannot offend me. I was concerned for you. I was interested, so I came. Did you see the lights?
Nope. Nary a light. I told you they wouldn't show up when anybody was up there.
You collected $5 from me, betting on the other side of the fence. You were the man who was so sure there'd be some sign.
I do not understand. You are both confusing everything, and you are both lying. There were lights on the peak when you were there, and I have a feeling you saw them. They were quite a show from here.
Well, this is the place to see them from. Closer up, you lose perspective.
Well, I must go. Friendship means nothing to you, so I will take my small hike back to the lodge again. Actually, I came to say that tomorrow I leave this miserable place and go home. I've endured all the health I can stand.
Now, that's a different story. We're sorry to see you go, fella.
My regards to the swamps. 10 to 1, when you get there, you'll wish you were back.
This I very much doubt. Goodbye, John. Goodbye.
Oh, there's a funny fellow. Hey, what are you doing?
Just feeling the stone step where he sat. I thought so.
He really liked us, but this time he was careful not to shake hands. Did you notice?
Yeah.
In spite of himself, he'd reached his limit of control. His temperature is going up.
Yeah, I guess it is.
He never could see a joke. And remember how he'd say something and then wait, as if he didn't understand it? And then all of a sudden it would come to him? He'd wait to pick our brains for every new word.
You mean Royston?
Royston is a name out of a hat. When that lad really goes home, he'll go with his buddies up there on that peak. I wonder which he is. Zim or Zet?
You have just heard X-1 presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. X-1 has brought you The Lights on Precipice Peak, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Stephen Tall and adapted for radio by Ernest Kinoy. Featured in the cast were Jim Bowles as John Drinkhart, Joseph Helgeson as his fellow climber Chuck Evers, Ted Osborne as Zell, and Court Benson as the man who called himself Royston. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Kenneth McGregor and is an NBC Radio Network production.
X-1 on Tuned to Yesterday from March 13th, 1957 on NBC. You're listening to an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Next, a story from Theodore Sturgeon, featured on Beyond Tomorrow. It's called Incident at Switchpath, taken from his original short story published in 1947 called The Sky Was Full of Ships. Incidentally, it was in that year that Sturgeon won the Argosy Short Story Competition for his work Bianca's Hands. An adaptation of his story next, hosted by sci-fi editor John Campbell Jr. from April 11, 1950 on CBS.
Let's go Beyond Tomorrow. Are you afraid to face tomorrow, or whatever may lie beyond tomorrow? Do you think you're up to spending a weekend on the moon, or entertaining house guests from Mars? Can you and your children adjust to the strange, new, wonderful world that is being wrought in the test tubes and cyclotrons of science beyond tomorrow? Beyond Tomorrow, a new program of probabilities drawn from the vast library of science fiction, where anything is possible and possibly may happen to you. Tonight, based on a famous story by Theodore Sturgeon and adapted by Draper Lewis, a tale about a man accused of murder in a small western town who insists it was not murder, but something really much worse.
All right! I'm presiding coroner here, and I'll handle this inquest my way, if you don't mind.
All right.
Now, look, Kemp, why can't you get it through your head that nobody's trying to railroad you into admitting anything? You're just a fella knows something about the death of this here Alessandro Sykes. And this court would like to know exactly what happened.
I'll tell you what happened. That kid killed Sykes, killed him dead in the doornail, and then brought the body back here and dumped it in his hotel room. That's what happened.
No, you're wrong. I didn't kill him. You're trying to accuse me of murder, but I tell you it's something worse. Something much, much worse than murder.
If we don't have it quiet in this courtroom, I'm going to have the sheriff clear the place. This inquest is going to be run legal-like or ain't going to be run at all.
You mean maybe we should have the hanging right now, Bert?
I didn't say no such thing.
Well, maybe you should and stop wasting so much time.
Well, that's fine. Mr. Wilson, sir, you can't let him hang me. I'm innocent, I tell you. I didn't kill Sykes. Aren't you even going to listen to what I got to say?
Sure, son, I'm going to listen. We're all going to listen. or I'm taking this boy into Tucson where there's a jury that will listen.
Well, this better be good. We don't like murder around Switchback.
Darn, we don't like strangers neither.
If you gentlemen are through now, suppose we hear what the boy has to say.
I don't know.
All right, son. Now let's get the facts straight first off. Your full name?
James Gordon Kemp.
And your home?
Chicago. Chicago, Illinois.
City bred, huh? Maybe that's why he don't give no mind to something like murder.
I thought you was always so proud about the times you've been to Tucson, Haverty.
Huh?
Seems to me wearing silk shirts is pretty city-fied, too. All right. Here, son. Sit down.
Thank you.
Now, suppose you tell us what happened. Tell us the whole story just like it happened.
Okay. I'll try. I guess I'd better go right back to the beginning. The first time I ever saw this here Sykes. It must have been about 2 months ago. I had a little repair shop at the time, just auto parts and maybe fooling around with radios and TV sets now and then. It didn't make no big profit, but it paid the rent and gave me a little extra pocket money. I was working in my shop one afternoon when he walked in. He watched what I was doing a couple of minutes. Then he spoke up.
You Gordon Kemp?
I said yes and looked him over. He was a scrawny fella, probably 60 years old, and wound up real tight. He talked fast, smoked fast, moved fast, as if there wasn't time for anything, but he had to get on to something else. I asked him what he wanted.
You the man had that article in the magazine about a concentrated atomic torch?
Yeah, only that guy from the magazine used a lot of loose talk. He says my torch is 300 years ahead of its time. Actually, it's something I stumbled on by accident, more or less. It's an ordinary atomic hydrogen torch, but it's plenty hot. It'll cut anything, anything. And since it got patented, you'd be surprised at the calls I got. You got no idea how many people want to cut into bank vaults and the side doors of hock shops.
I'd like to take a few weeks off and go out west. Arizona? I want you to cut your way into a cave there.
A cave? Is it legal?
Sure it's legal.
How legal?
You get me into that place. You can satisfy yourself as to whether it's legal. I'll give you $5,000.
What?
Cash.
How's that again?
Get me into that cave, and you'll get $5,000 cash.
How come you happen to run across this here cave, Professor Sykes? Didn't anyone else in Switch Path ever spot it?
Yeah, from what I can gather, there must have been a shifting of rock. Maybe a slight earth tremor that opened it up. The time I was fresh out of college, spending all my time digging for Indian ruins, I found it at the bottom of a deep cleft. Small, dark room, all rock walls. It was rock that was very old. A couple of 100,000 years. Maybe 500,000.
Half million?
It wasn't the rock that got me so excited. It wasn't the rock and it wasn't the cave. It was the machinery in the cave.
What?
Machinery that must have been put there before there were any human beings on Earth.
Oh, not just a minute, Professor.
Now, look. I don't care whether you believe me or not. I know what I'm talking about. Those machines were installed in that cave room back when there wasn't a single living creature of any sort.
But that doesn't make sense. If there are machines, then some human beings must have made them. Some human beings must have hauled them into the cave and assembled them. Only you say there weren't any human beings on Earth.
Maybe not on Earth, Kemp. But there are human beings someplace else. At least, beings. Who knows whether they're human or not?
Wow. That's a nice, pleasant thought.
Yes. I thought so, too, at the time. I've gotten used to it now. I got used to it during all the days and nights I stayed in that room and studied that machinery.
What What kind of machinery was it?
Well, I finally figured out that one of them was some sort of a radio transmitter. Now, get this. Here's a machine with an antenna on top of it, just like a microwave job. Beside it is another machine. The second machine is shaped like a dumbbell standing on one end. Top of it is sort of a covered hopper. At the waist of the machine are two big spools with a wire running between them made out of some alloy that was never seen before on this earth.
Were they running?
One was running, making a slight humming sound. The dumbbell machine was running, and that's what gave me a clue to what it was. That machine is a recorder. And that automatically makes the other machine a transmitter.
A recorder? What kind of a recorder?
It records the physical being of the entire Earth. Every earthquake, every continental shift, weather cycles, every hurricane and volcano eruption and landslide. Now here, take a look at this.
A piece of wire, huh? About 35 gauge. Money tough.
Yes. I cut it off the recording machine. Kemp, my boy, it took a long time, a lot of years out of my life. I finally got it decoded. I can read that wire. You've no idea in what detail that piece of wire records, second by second, minute by minute, day by day, through the years, through the centuries. When I start my decoding, I'll be able to prove things which until now have only been guessed, only whispered about in the history books of the world. I'll be able to give the exact time and date when the Red Sea parted for the fleeing Israelites. You want to know what happened to the Spanish Armada? I have it all here. What about the last days of Pompeii? I have it, son. I have it. And I am going to give it to the world. Me, Alessandro Sykes. Give it to humanity complete and provable, and history will be reckoned from the day I speak.
I admit he did sound a little off his rocker. And if I had any sense, I would have gotten off that train and gone back to Chicago. But he was such a nice little guy. As nice a little character as you'd ever want to meet. And he figured he had something big in that cave.
Yes,
I tell you, something important enough that he'd been living with it, thinking about it, working on it day in and day out for 30 years or more. You can't let that kind of a guy down.
All of us here knew Sykes pretty well, Camp. His family was among the first settlers in Switchbath. Came in on a wagon train just before the rush in 49. We knew he spent a lot of time digging around in the desert, but we never heard about no cave.
It's 30 miles or so to the east of town. You pass a big rock formation. It's shaped like a crescent. And the cave's a little further
up. I've been out by Crescent Rock more times than I can count, and I never see no cave.
But you wouldn't see it if you didn't climb into the cleft.
Something happened out there just about 2 years ago. Ground was hot for miles around. All the grass shriveled up and died. Nothing's grown there since.
Yeah, besides, if Sykes had found a cave, he certainly would have told somebody here in town. Ain't like he was an outsider, if you know what I mean.
For sure.
That cave was there. It's not there now, but it was there, and I was in it. Sykes didn't tell anyone else about it because he knew no one would believe him. He wanted to get his proof first.
And what makes you think we believe you, Kemp?
This is the truth, I'm telling you. This is how it happened.
And you still haven't told us about the killing yet.
No, how about that?
I said this inquest was going to be run legal now, boys.
Hey, we're wasting a lot of time. The whole story smells to high heaven, and you know it.
I ain't passing judgment one way or the other till I hear what the boy has to say. And I still mean what I said about having the court clear. All right. Now, go on, Kemp. What happened when you got here to Switchbath with Sykes?
I don't think anyone will remember the night we arrived. I was dead tired from the trip, and I wanted to get some sleep. But the professor was all for getting out of town as quick as possible. He didn't want to answer any questions. So we piled all the stuff into his rattly old car and started for Crescent Rock. It was plenty spooky driving across the desert at night. It was a cold wind. It kicked up the dust, and you breathed dust. Bit into it. The old man kept peering straight ahead. And every now and then he'd change the direction.
Swing a little to the right, son. It's an old castle trail. We follow it for 5 miles or so.
He knew the way perfect.
It's Crescent Rock way up there ahead. Just keep it head on.
We didn't detour or backtrack once.
It's another 10 miles now. Distance is pretty tricky out here. Things look closer than they really are.
And then, just as it began to get near dawn, the sky was all smoky and you could start seeing the scrub weeds and cactus growing around the trail. Sykes grabbed my arm and said...
Well, pull up here, son. Walk the rest of the way to the cave. I don't want anybody snooping around while we're down there with those machines. I don't want anyone to know a thing until I'm ready to tell them. Just about 100 feet or so to meet the entrance to the room, son.
Boy, I never knew how much this torch weighed till I had it strapped on my back.
Sure I can't give you a hand with it?
No, it's okay, Professor. Don't worry.
Over there, that's all that's left of the place where I used to camp at night. I was afraid to sleep in the room, afraid to sleep outside the cleft. I used to make a fire and bed down on the rock.
Can't say I'd enjoy that over a long period of time.
You can get used to anything if it's important enough. I got used to the dark, the sound of little animals scurrying around, the damp, the smell. Wait.
Huh?
This is it, Kemp. You can take off your pack, yeah?
There. Oh, that feels better. Oh, I'm glad I can still straighten up.
You see that place there? Between the two pillar formations? That's it, son. And it's all yours. If that 300 years in the future torch of yours is any good, now's the time to prove it.
And now, back to our story.
Okay. Now stand clear of the equipment, Professor. Sure that tank is balanced squarely?
We can pile a few more rocks around it.
Yeah, well, we'll give it a try this way. If it starts to move, just give a shout.
I'll watch it, Kent.
Well, here we go.
How long do you think it'll take, Kent?
I don't know. It depends on how thick the rock is that's sealing up this room.
Kemp, think of it. On this little piece of wire, I have a complete record of the movement of the polar glacier, which will have all the learned busybodies gnashing their teeth. But have I said anything? Not me. Not Sykes? I'll wait till I can get the whole spool of wire, and I'll translate it into a history of the Earth and mankind written in such detail, with such authority, that the name of Sykes will go into the language as a synonym of the miraculously accurate. Me, Alessandro Sykes.
Hand me those black goggles, huh? How long have we been at it now, Professor?
Almost 3 hours, son. You better let me spare you.
No, I'll take a breather when I need one. This torch is too heavy for you to handle. By the way, whatever happened to the entrance you used before? How can we have to burn our way in like this?
That, my boy, is an unforeseen quality of the machines. For some reason, they closed themselves up. In a way, I'm glad they did. I was unable to get back in. I was forced to concentrate on my sample. If it hadn't been for that, I doubt I would ever have cracked the code. Whoever left these machines here or how they operate, we may never know. It would be interesting to find out. The important thing now is to get into that room and get that spool of wire. That's all that matters, son. That's all that matters.
Oh, 6 hours and only 7.5 inches. I've seen that torch of mine walk in a laminated bank vault like the door was open. What kind of rock is this, anyhow?
There must have been some chemical substance added that we don't know about when the room was sealed.
And you think that machine will still be running after the blast of heat it must have took to build this wall?
It'll be running. They'll both be running. The recorder and the transmitter.
What do you mean? The transmitter.
Because the recorder was set to trip it off. I found that out, too. There's a little gear train waiting by the wire, and when something happened, somewhere on Earth, it was just the right thing. Crimp would show in the wire, which would hit the gear train and start up the transmitter.
Yes, but you said...
I saw a crimp in the wire. Something happened which put a wiggle in it, the thing I was looking for all along. I was in the cave the day it happened. There was a sharp click. The transmitter started up, and the wire kept on recording. I looked in the papers the next week to see what it was. I couldn't find a thing. It wasn't until the following August that I found out.
What was the date when it started to transmit?
July 16, 1945.
July 16th.
The day the first atom bomb was exploded at Los Alamos, New Mexico.
Okay. Okay, Professor. Hold the light a little higher. This should do it now. Well, there it is. Wait a minute or so while those edges cool.
30 years' work. 30 years, Kemp.
Professor, who do you think's on the receiving end of that transmitter?
I don't know. I'm only sure whoever he is or they are, they're not any place on this earth. That's why I've been so anxious to get into the room.
Well, we'll throw that canvas over the edges, just safe. Now, you take the big flashlight. I'll bring the lamp.
We can remove the spool of wire and then destroy the machines. It won't be any good to anyone else once the recording device is disconnected. The light, Kemp. Bring in the light quickly.
Yeah.
Quickly.
Yeah, I'm right behind you, Professor. Oh, brother, you aren't kidding about that machinery, were you?
They're beautiful, aren't they, Kemp?
I've never seen anything that looks like that transmitter.
And the recorder, Kemp. Come closer. Examine the recorder. Listen to it humming, Kemp. I knew it would be humming. It's recording everything that's happening to the Earth, the whole Earth. Will we stand here and listen to it humming?
Professor, maybe we better get the wire and get out of here. This place gives me the willies.
Don't be frightened, son. Machines can't hurt you.
It's not the machines. I just don't like this place. Let me hold a flashlight. You disconnect the spool.
There should be a catch lever of some sort which frees it. Something like a movie camera or one of those old-fashioned wire recorders.
Yeah, well, maybe I can find it, Professor. I've worked with these things.
No, I know. No, I can find it. Just let me alone. You forget that I've been... Oh, Kemp.
What's the matter, Professor?
Kemp, the reel is empty. Look. It's only 8 inches of wire on it. Only 8 inches, Kemp. It was almost full before the cave was sealed.
But that's impossible. No one could get through that rock. No one, I tell you.
The reel's been refilled. That's what's happened. It's been refilled. Kemp, they've been here.
Who's been here, Professor?
That's what the transmitter was for, Kemp. Tell them when the first atomic power was used on Earth. The recorder tripped the transmitter. It sent out a signal. They answered it and came here and changed the reel. It's the beginning of a new era, as far as they're concerned.
Sykes, who are you talking about? Who are they?
What do you mean?
I don't know. I don't know, but they've been here. And I've lost 30 years' work. 30 years of my life completely gone, disappeared.
Professor, you gotta pull yourself together. We gotta get out of here. I don't like this at all.
Get out? Why get out? Damage has been done now. The wheel's gone.
I don't like the way that thing hums. Sounds like it's just sitting there, waiting and... Crimp. It hit another crimp in the wire. The transmitter started again.
Doesn't matter now. Nothing matters now. Nothing.
Come on and grab that light. I've had enough of this.
No. I'm going to stay here.
You're not staying in this cave. You're coming with me if I have to carry you.
No, let me alone.
Come on.
I'm staying here, Kemp, let go of me.
No.
Let go.
Professor, watch out for that recorder. Professor.
My hands.
Sykes, are you all right?
My hands. Burn my hands. It's so hot.
Yes. Both hands. It's getting hotter every second. Come on. We got to move. Somebody tells me this place is going to blow sky high.
Put
your arm across my shoulder. I'll guide you out through the cleft.
Your school. 30 years' work.
Stop talking and walk, Professor. We're getting out of here and fast.
I don't remember much about that climb up through the cleft, dragging Sykes with me every inch of the way. I just knew it was hot. I could hear rock falling and rock bubbling thick and heavy behind me down there in that terrible room. I somehow got to the car and stretched Sykes out of the back seat. I asked him how he was, but he didn't answer me. He just kept looking back towards the cleft and the glow of the lava. And then he whispered... They knew we'd reached the atomic age. They wanted to be told when. That's what the transmitter did. They came and took the recordings, filled the machine.
Don't try to talk, Professor. I'm going to drive you into town and we'll get the doctor to take care of those hands of yours.
They sealed off the room with something they thought only controlled atomic power could break into. This time the recorder was triggered to that power. Your torch did it, Kemp. That 300 years in the future torch that did it. They think we have atomic power. They'll come back, Kemp.
Who, Professor? Who?
I don't know. I don't know whether they're friends or enemies or where they are. There'd be only one reason why someone, some creature, would want to know a thing like that. That's so they could stop us.
Oh, no, Professor. We're not going to be stopped now. Like the papers say, we're in the atomic age if it kills us. But we're in for keeps. Why, humanity would have to be killed off before to get out of this atomic age.
I know that, Kemp. I know. That's what I mean. Kemp, what have we done? What have we done?
Professor? Professor Sykes. I was going to bury him there, out there near the cleft. I thought he'd like to be there. But then I realized that people would be wondering about him, looking for him. So I brought him in. In the excitement, I left town. It just didn't look good to me. I knew nobody would listen to a yarn like that.
Well, now I can see what Brother Kemp was worried about. That story is true. I, for one, would think twice about telling him.
He's a liar. He's a murdered liar.
I caught a kid that reads that kind of stuff, and I never did like to see him at it. Believe me, he's going to cut it out as of right now.
I think this Kemp guy needs a hanger. Wait a minute, man. If we kill off this fellow, we do it legal, see? You just keep quiet a while longer, and let me ask this boy a question. Now, look, Kemp. If there's anything in your story, or in that goofy idea the dead man's about someone coming to kill us off, well, ain't it about time they did?
Yeah! When's the invasion start, Kemp?
Yeah, maybe we should start digging foxholes now, huh, Kemp?
I didn't say anything about that. I just told you the facts the way they happened. I just told you what Sykes told me.
The whole thing's a lousy pack of lies. It's all lies. Lies!
Wilson! Wilson! That was a bomb!
Yeah, Wilson, look! There!
In the sky! Look!
Ships! Ships!
The sky is full of ships!
Beyond Tomorrow, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 11th of April, 1950, on CBS. And that brings the curtain down on this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.